the knowledge that I learned to get into apartment buildings are very transferable to the other asset classes. Like once I learn how to evaluate apartment building, the cap rate and the NOI, it doesn't take much to invest as a limited partner in a self-storage because the fundamentals are basically the same of how they value it.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Dennis Shapiro began investing in real estate in 2012. He has progressed to investing in active and passive deals across various asset types and classes. Dennis has invested in note funds, promissory notes, mobile home parks, affordable housing rentals, industrial space, short-term vacation rentals, crowdfunding platforms, and luxury apartment communities. Graduating from Baruch College, Dennis began working for the United States government. It was a job he probably performed for over a decade. In his various roles in the government, he served as a liaison to the public and various state agencies. Working for such a large institution provided him with a unique view of the importance of portfolio allocation and management. Dennis, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
Hey, man, the pleasure's mine. You know, quickly, can you give us, some of this was in your bio here, but quickly give our listeners an idea of where'd you start, where are you now, and how did you get there?
Sure. So I started investing in traditional assets like stocks and bonds 20 years ago when I was in high school. My oldest brother gave me a copy of Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I didn't really fully grasp the book, but I bought my first asset at the time. I kind of fell in love with stocks and publicly traded instruments. And then the global financial crisis hit. And I was in college for that to become a fund manager. And I was going to interview for certain positions. And by the second or third round, the place I was interviewing was no longer in business. So when I finished college, I was looking around. I was like, hey, what should I do? And I was like, hey, let me just go back to school. So I went back for my MBA. And that's when I got recruited for the government. And the moment I got my first paycheck from the government, I realized that besides being my employer, they were also my business partner because of the amount of taxes they were taking. So that kind of got me in the loophole, the rabbit hole of how to pay less taxes. That got me into real estate. I bought my first rental property and that thing was a nightmare and everything that can possibly go wrong went wrong. And it, in a good way, because I looked at it, I was like, wow, I don't want to scale these nightmares 100x. Right. So what other ways can I get the benefits of real estate without dealing with the actual day-to-day? That's when I kind of got into syndications and note funds and ATM funds, just more passive ways of creating income than just rental properties and stuff like that. And throughout the whole process, what I was realizing was I never sold all my stocks at the time. Too many times I was meeting investors and it's like, oh, I stumbled onto real estate. That's great. Now I'm going to sell everything that I was doing before and I'm going to go full blown into this. What I was realizing is that it was just really hard to create income from my traditional portfolio of stocks and bonds. And regardless of the different strategies, they just never worked out. High dividend companies and utility companies, the same thing kept happening over and over again. The volatility in the stock market killed the yield. Right. And what I was realizing on my alternative side was that the alternatives, because they were mostly private securities, had no volatility practically. And I was able to have a much more dependable yield. And by considering it an end situation where it's traditional and alternative versus which one's better, I started saying, okay, I could leave the traditional on autopilot, but I'm just going to do a low cost index fund, set it, forget it, but spend all my brain power on the alternative side, which requires networking and doing due diligence and underwriting and everything like that. And when I merged the two, that's when things really started clicking for me.
That's awesome. That's one of the things, and I'm guilty of it, you know, of saying, look, you know, I at some point I just took everything out of the stock market and said, bag it, you know, I'm going to do, everything's going to be what I can touch and see and generate an income from. And so I think it's interesting always to have people on that go, okay, there's a potential hybrid approach to this process. So how did you figure out what that allocation looked like for you and how it made sense?
Honestly, it took me decades. So it was not something that was overnight. I knew I wanted two things from my portfolio. I wanted appreciation and income. So I was part of like the early retiree movement. So I didn't have 35 years to, you know, grow my portfolio. I needed to have a portfolio that can grow and provide income if I chose to leave my job. And at the same time, I had three kids. So it's not like I wanted to take out and then leave my kids with nothing, you know, when it's time for me to, you know, decease. So I had this I knew I needed to accomplish three things. I needed the income, I needed appreciation, and I needed something to leave behind. And the traditional side just wasn't doing it. So how it came into an actual portfolio allocation, it was just over time. It was, I realized I had enough built up in traditional where I was like, it's on autopilot. I don't even have to reinvest anymore. I have enough. It'll grow on itself. I don't have to put any additional funds here. Now I could focus my attention because it's kind of like a well-run business at this point.
Right.
Where it's enough. But the alternative side, that's the side where I was like, wow, this is not only, you know, lucrative, profitable, but it was also really, it became like a passion of mine. Like I started really loving commercial real estate. It wasn't just, hey, I'm making money. It was like, wait, this project helped 52 families because it turned the rundown mobile home park into something that's way better. I'm like, this is pretty cool. I don't get that experience on the stock market. And I think as I progressed, as I developed more and more relationships on the alternative side, I wanted to do more and more stuff with alternatives. And I had to actually like almost taper my excitement down and just remind myself, you know, having stocks is a good thing. And then later on, what I found is once you reach certain thresholds in your portfolio, you could actually collateralize your portfolio and then put it into additional alternative assets. So you could kind of have the best of both ways where you don't actually have to sell your assets and you can kind of create a line of credit from them. Again, this is not financial advice, but the point is that if you start thinking of it as an end situation and not that I have to sell this in order to get this, you'll be surprised. There's a lot of actual options out there where you don't actually have to sell. You could collateralize.
That's interesting. Yeah. And that's a topic I don't know anything about. And so at some point, you know, would love to dive deeper, you know, into what that looks like. But as you've scaled your alternative asset side of things, what was your key to getting that done? Without, you know, I think one of the things you said about your stocks and bond portfolio was kind of set it and forget it. How did you scale your alternative asset side of things without just creating another job for yourself?
Yes, I guess the set it forget it model in the alternative world is almost the complete opposite. It does take a lot of work initially. The work definitely tapers off after a certain time period. So I kind of have a flow chart of, now that I looked back at it, it's like, what did I do well? What didn't I do well? And when I was starting off with zero and, you know, maybe I had one or two syndication investments and not really much, didn't have a network, nothing like that. What I realized was really helpful is I added the words investor into my LinkedIn profile, just like real estate investor. You could really do it, tweak it to whatever alternative investments that you're actually passionate about. What ended up happening is within minutes, I was getting kind of like spammy. Hey, all of a sudden, you know, 12 brokers reached out to me and 12 insurance guys reached out to me. All of a sudden, I was like, wow, I'm super popular. Everybody wants 15 minutes of my time. And then, you know, and it can get spammy really quick. But what I realized is during having some of those conversations where I wasn't fully aware that they're fully spam, I was still trying to embrace it. What is being said to me? What don't I understand? What terminology is being used? Because the language of real estate has its own separate metrics that you really have to know. Like if you don't know what a cap rate is or NOI or what a value add versus a stabilized deal is, like you shouldn't be parking $50,000 into a deal. So what I realized is I was using those calls to really get myself an education in the process. And then once I had that education, then I started actually going out to conferences. And when I was actually in conferences, now I was like, okay, I've done a few deals. I know the language. What have you done? And you start relating with other people who are doing similar investments. Like if I'm a limited partner in 2-3 syndications, I could relate to other limited partners, whether they dumped 20 or one. So you start gravitating to those people. And once you have like a network of like-minded people, and then you start getting recommended to masterminds and coaching programs and all this other stuff. But just taking that step where you're networking with 5-6 different, like let's say apartment building investors, and you could get on a call with them on a quarterly basis, the scalability of your portfolio is unmatched.
Right.
Because what's going to happen during those conversations? A, it's going to take a while to get to real conversations. You just have to realize that because a lot of times, a lot of this information is not really fully disclosed. According to every operator, they're the world's greatest operator, right? It's a marketing ploy in itself. But when you're talking to other investors in the space and they just parked $50,000, and if that investment's probably not doing too well, you know, after a few phone calls, they'll really kind of give it away. They'll say, hey, you know, you're looking to do this deal with operators such and such, you might want to be careful because I'm in one of his deals and it's not doing that well, right, or it stopped distributions. Just be careful. And then you kind of start seeing patterns because you're having these conversations, which markets are doing really well, which business plans are executing. You know, hey, I've seen dog parks. Do they really work that well? How many dog parks have you invested in? How much is the average rent increase with a dog park? You want to see the limit. And then once you have knowledge, certain education, certain network, the last step in the process for me in the scalability is actually to learn underwriting. And it's not underwriting to the point where you need to, you know, present the deal to someone else. It's underwriting to where you know the basics of the basics. Right. And just from an investor perspective, because what you want to be able to do is see how aggressive those assumptions that are being in the deal actually are. And you're only ever going to get that if you know how to like reverse and say, hey, once you have some basic underwriting, you know which variable levers to pull where it's a little tweak here and there. And all of a sudden you see a huge jump in your IRR. So you need to get to that point where you know that. Right. And so those are the three things that I say, like, hey, if you do these three things, becoming an investor is super scalable at that point. And then deal number 17, after you looked at 16 deals like that, becomes like a 5-minute process.
Right.
From an investor perspective, it's just so much quicker. So, you know, there's a process to get to that point, but it does take work to get to that point.
Sure. No, I think that's great. That's great. And I love the simplicity of how you've laid that process out. Excuse me. One of the things that, you know, that you talk about is starting an investment club. And, you know, what are some of the advantages and potential disadvantages for an investment club that you've started? And then what was your process for starting that?
So investment clubs are very broad. So I'm going to specifically just talk about my experience with the specific investment club that I created. So what ended up happening is because alternative investments, because they're private securities, that they tend to have the higher minimums. Right. So what I realized is when I was networking with people out there, especially my first couple of, one person was working on my 9-to-5. The other one I met at an investor presentation. What I realized is that if you could combine forces, you could get into so many more deals, and then your learning curve will increase exponentially. Because instead of doing 3 deals on your own, you got 10 deals, you got people picking the deals apart, and it's the same amount of capital.
Right.
So it you're kind of creating your own little investment fund kind of situation. Now, there were a couple of nuances that I did learn in the process that I would love to share because they're so significant. One of them is that you need to consider it as like a dating process where it shouldn't be like, hey, I met this guy in a meetup, let's start an investment club tomorrow. Like this should be like 6 months of you guys analyzing deals together where you need to see if there's you like literally like, would you marry this person type of situation? Because once, you know, that money is committed and it's a 10-year investment, that's longer than most marriages last these days. So you have to be very, very careful during the dating process. The second thing, which is really important, is you have to understand if you're creating a security or not. This is probably the most important thing that I learned in this process. So what happens is in the investment club that I had, it was only 3 people. So it was much easier not to create a security because as long as all of us were actively involved in the participation of the decisions and had active roles within the club, we were fine. Though the issue became is if one member went into the passive side, then we would need a securities document and everything like that, because then the other 2 members are kind of controlling the way that those investments are made. So when you're creating an investment club, the pros is that it will allow you to get into more deals and it'll allow you to leverage knowledge that you don't have. So for example, my core competency is apartment buildings. That's what I love to analyze. I analyze a lot of them. You know, I'm a general partner in a few deals myself. So that's my core competency. But then if one of my partners has a crypto core competency, and you know, before talking to him, I thought it was speculative, and then when talking to him, I'm like, okay, now I kind of understand because I'm leveraging his knowledge to feel better about it. And then I had another partner who does startup tech funds. So now it's when you're in an investment club, you kind of will get a much broader opportunities where if it was just you, like me personally, I probably wouldn't invest in a tech startup myself because I don't have the capabilities of, it would basically be gambling if I did it.
Sure.
But if I have someone who's, you know, if you're teaming up with Elon Musk or, you know, Mark Cuban, and he tells you this is pretty good startup, it's not gambling at that point because you're leveraging his years and years and years of knowledge. So those are the pros on the investment club side. The cons is you have to be careful. You might want to talk to a securities attorney. You definitely don't want to skate those lines because there's a lot of problems that can be had. And the last thing is, it's actually, if you get members, like-minded members who are actively involved, it's as simple as really doing like an operating agreement and just setting up just an LLC. It gets much more complicated once you reach the realms of a security.
How did you guys, okay, so there's three of you in an investment club, but what was the role of the investment club outside of just three people getting together and talking about different investments?
There was no role initially. It was a very organic process. It was, what happened was, on one of the investors, I went to a winery in the Northeast that was doing investor presentation, very cool project. It's a syndication, but it had a wedding business model versus a thing. And what happened was, there was a room of about 100 investors, and me and this fellow investor, we were like literally plastering the operator with so many questions, where the operator said, why don't you two hold back? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other questions that they were answering were like, you know, baby questions. Like, but we were like going, we were trying to get into the business model, really try to wrap our heads around. And we were both realizing that our questions had a lot of synergies. And then afterwards, we exchanged contact information. My partner ended up investing. I ended up not, but we spent like 3 to 4 months just talking about that deal.
Oh, wow.
So before even the investment club was formed, we were doing things that investment club would need to do. You need to, you know, fact check each other. You need to play devil's advocate. You need to say like, well, you know, how does this fit your overall portfolio? So that's something you want to be very honest with your other investment club people, because, you know, you guys have a game plan. If you make a series of investments that's supposed to last 10 years, and in 3 years, one of you guys has a huge life-changing event that you voluntarily went into, that's going to affect the other two people. So all of those things play a role, but investment club is like one of those pros and cons. There's a lot of pros to it. There's some cons to it. And you just have to be careful, where it sounds really cool and sounds really complicated, but it could be really simple and beneficial.
Right, right. So are you an active sponsor of deals, or do you partner with other sponsors in the industry and just—
Yes. So this has been years of networking. So this year I launched an income fund. So the income fund was really designed to be like a REIT that's not publicly traded. So that I'm mostly a limited partner in, and I'll invest in other people's deals and other people's funds. But on the side with my investor list, when I get opportunities to be as a partner on certain deals, I'll present that as well to my investor, you know, list, because I've already vetted the deal myself. So there's basically, that's kind of what we do both ways. So we are limited partners in the fund side of things. And then for certain deals, I'll co-partner, but it's mostly I'm partnering with a different operator at that point.
Got it. Got it. What's it been like raising money for a multi-asset fund when you're talking to potential investors?
It's been difficult in the sense that before this year, I really didn't have a brand. So the type of marketing that, you know, people usually recommend is like local networking events and everything like that. That's been impossible to do for the last year or so.
Right.
So it's the presence of social media. Like I said, it becomes a much more marketing. It's more like my job profession almost is like a marketer, and a fund operator is a secondary portion. Right. But what I realized is that there's certain people who really, really prioritize capital preservation and consistent income, where they're not looking for, you know, 20-30% returns. They're just looking for, at the end of the day, do they understand what the investment is actually about? Is it consistent enough for them? And that's what they're really, really looking for. Now, the investors that are looking for, I guess, the higher alpha, the higher returns, that's where single deals are better, because the fund will normalize those returns. That's kind of the whole benefit of a fund. Sure. But the individual deals, and I always try to explain that to investors, like, you could get the outsized deals. You just have to invest in one particular deal, because it could be a home run, or on the flip side, it could be the complete opposite, a strikeout. So you have to be, you know, you have to align yourself with what your goals are.
Got it. Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely key. And that's one of the things that we've talked about a lot is like you just said, single deal can be the home run, or it can be a complete flop. which that brings in the beauty of funds. I just, one of the things that, you know, we hear a lot about, I think funds are becoming more and more popular, but, you know, a multi-asset fund isn't something we hear a lot about. So I was really just curious what that looks like. You said that the FIRE movement is missing out on something. What does that mean?
So the FIRE movement, for just to reiterate what it actually is, financial independence, retire early. It's basically, I'd say it's only been around for a decade, two decades. There's right. been some early adopters that really were in like the 70s and 80s, but I would say it's been taking off really in the last 10 to 15 years. And what basically was discovered that if you live within 25 times your annual expenses, then once you get to that number, you'll live basically on 4% of your income a year, and your money should be able to last till perpetuity. There's been a couple of studies in the, I believe, 1990s or in the 2000s, the Trinity study, I forget the exact year, but basically they went back and they analyzed every single scenario of how long your money will last. And they said, within reason, if you make adjustments and you can hit a 4% return, but then adjust it depending on the market corrections and returns, then your money should last you for the rest of your life. So there's that. What ends up happening is, you know, a lot of people in their 20s and 30s were looking at this and say, wow, okay, I don't need millions and millions to retire. If I cut back on some of my expenses and I could hit 25 times that in stock markets and real estate or whatever their asset allocation is, I could retire today. I could retire at 30 and 25. A lot of people in the movement were in the mid 20s and they were already retired. I joined the movement, I guess, in the 20s. And then what ends up happening is once you get this magic number that you work out, you know, the Excel tells you, oh, I need $689,473. All of a sudden that becomes like a glaring light on almost every decision you end up making. Because it's like, oh, I need to get to that number. Because once I get to that number, I don't have to wake up in the morning if I don't want to. You know, I could watch all Netflix I want to. You know, I could do whatever I want. And then what ends up happening is you delay a lot of gratification. And if you don't delay a lot of gratification, you usually create this like this bucket list of items that you're going to do the moment, you know, you pull the cord and you're retired. Usually it's some form of traveling, catching up on, you know, Netflix. And then like the third thing is like spending more time with the kids. And usually that incorporates like some kind of homeschooling. And what they're not doing during this process is building their life after. What they don't realize, all those are check boxes. So what happens is they retire, then they go traveling. And then all of a sudden they come home because you can only travel so much. Sure. And, you know, you eventually want to go home. And then you go and you catch up on your Netflix. And then there's nothing more to catch up. And then you keep your kid home from one day from school. And you realize homeschooling kind of sucks, actually. And you can't pay your teachers enough money for taking your kids and actually teaching them and everything like that. So what ends up happening is now you're like, all right, what do I do? Your whole social life basically is from you know, blogs and your past job, which you no longer work. And during this whole process, you really haven't built up that, you know, the passion. That's why I was pretty lucky on, well, while I was chasing that number, I started really, really getting into alternative assets. And I was like, you know what, I'm actually really passionate about this. And I was like, if I quit my 9-to-5, all I'm going to do is just do this full time. I'm going to be looking at apartment buildings and stuff like this because I can do this. I enjoy doing this. I enjoy making investments for people. This is what I want to do. And I think there's too many times that they get into this tunnel vision that they can't focus on the after.
Right, man. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a real good point. Yeah. And the other thing is that life is now. You know, today is all you have. So it, as much as I want to delay gratification, as much as I want to postpone, you know, some of those things for saving for tomorrow and things like that, you've also got to enjoy the time you've been given, which all you have is right now. So, you know, trying to find that balance there is probably unique to everyone, but certainly you present it from a unique perspective.
And it's a challenge. I would even say that it's a huge challenge as an investor to have a present mentality, because the whole concept of investment is going against that. Right. And it's something I've been victim to for so many years. And that, you know, I've been fighting it recently, like understanding that there is a present, right? It's not just about the gratification that comes in tomorrow's investment.
Right, right. Man, you hit that. You hit that on the head. Let's talk a little bit about the book that you wrote, The Alternative Investment Almanac, Expert Insights on Building Personal Wealth in Non-Traditional Ways. What's the book about?
Yeah, so I was spending years in, I was approaching 2-3 years of heavy dose networking where I was on calls 3 days a week. And what ended up happening is, even though I started in the apartment building world, I started realizing as I was speaking to an apartment building investor, they would tell me about the self-storage deal that they did, or the mobile home park deal, or how they use life insurance policies part of their investment strategy. So I started getting these conversations, and they would just keep repeating and repeating and repeating. Right. And I, every time I got a conversation and they made a referral for me, and I would reach out to a self-storage operator, I started getting more and more knowledgeable about not just apartment buildings and all these different assets that really are, you know, related, but are slightly different. And when I realized is the knowledge that I learned to get into apartment buildings are very transferable to the other asset classes. Like once I learn how to evaluate apartment building, the cap rate and the NOI, it doesn't take much to invest as a limited partner in a self-storage because the fundamentals are basically the same of how they value it. The business plan is a little bit different, but the valuation is all the same. So what I realized is I had this collection of assets that many people who are not in my alternative investment network, when I would talk to in a barbecue or whatever it is with a friend, they would look at that stuff and be like, oh, that's a Ponzi scheme, you know, like the fact that you do that. And you get these conversations and you're like, wow, that's actually not true. That's just, you know, misconceptions that there's a whole world of these really easy to get into assets. They might not be easy to always invest from day one, but there is a whole world of them. And, you know, unfortunately, there is a large advisory community that's kind of against these alternative investments for their personal, for their own reasons. Right. But the bottom line is a large chunk of the population out there do not realize that there's this world out there that can be a huge tool in their own portfolios, where, you know, how many times do you hear like an elderly person who's approaching their retirement and saying, well, I have to wait till 70 to take Social Security, or I have to do this because my portfolio is yielding 2% on the thing. And it's a shame, but there's a whole world out there. So when I started writing this book, it was basically from those conversations. I wanted to show that people who only think in traditional ways, that there is this whole world of alternative investments. And then I still wanted to show the alternative space that there are some benefits of still incorporating a traditional portfolio. And the way I structured the book is that instead of, you know, throwing out 300 pages on each asset class, I wanted to kind of give, I kind of have the walkthrough of how I got to where I am today. But then it goes into these asset classes where there's a chapter where it'll be 20, 30 pages about apartment buildings, the basics, the everything you really kind of need to know. And then it gets into two Q&As with experts in that space, with expert operators in that space. So now you could read those 20 pages as someone who's new to the space. If you like it, that's great. Then you could go in and kind of get into the rabbit hole of apartment buildings. You know, you get into the podcast, listen to all the great educational stuff out there. But now you could kind of get into that rabbit hole. Or you can read those 20, 30 pages and say, you know what? I just don't like this concept. I'm not going to make money off people living. I'm just not going to invest in apartment buildings. But then the next chapter is self-storage. So you same thing, 20, 30 pages, get into the high level. So after you read this book, you'll be introduced to 8 or 9 asset classes that are different, that you may have never known that you can invest. Like how many people know that you can invest in life insurance settlements? Like, you know, like how many people know that? And it's not a lot. And something like that, people are like, oh, you know, that's actually interesting. People do die. That seems like morbid, but it would be an interesting investment. So I wanted to really introduce people to these different topics.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, that the book sounds like a great read, and I love how you've structured that in such a way that you can read a few pages on the subject, and then if you're not interested any further, just move on. So I think that's really great. Dennis, I've certainly enjoyed our interview today. It's time for us to jump here into the final four questions. The first one is this. If I gave you just $20,000 to invest in real estate with no previous real estate investing experience, what would you do with it and why?
I would try to get involved, okay, with no previous experience. So that's the hard part. With no previous experience. Now, is it no previous operational experience or educational experience counts?
I don't know. It's your answer. Take it anywhere you want.
Okay. I would definitely say you shouldn't invest at all with zero educational experience. So I'll say if you have an underlying educational experience but haven't done an actual deal, I really like the joint venture route, especially if you have someone to partner with. You could overcompensate, maybe not providing your fair share of capital by work ethic, and especially if you get a deal localized and really be the boots on the ground, stuff like that. I think that's the best way. Joint venture and then make up your share of the contribution with your hard work.
Right. I love that. If you could help our listeners avoid just one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
Buying in a low income area. That's by far, I bought my first property, low income area. I went through evictions and gut jobs and break-ins and great stories from it, but not a good investment. So, you know, it's appealing. Like you said, oh, if you had $20,000, how would you start? And you look at a property and it's like, oh, it's $24,000. I could buy this thing cash. How could I lose? You will lose. The answer is not how you could lose. You will lose. So stay away, buy quality, even if it means owning a smaller share. And that's a huge, I would say, I'll throw that out there. It's okay to buy a small share of a good product versus a large share of a big headache.
Right, man. Yeah, good advice there. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one way you are making the world a better place?
I would say investing in commercial real estate. A lot of people don't understand that if you invest with the right operator and they're ethically, you know, they have an ethical moral code, they're not trying to get every dollar out of the property. What they're trying to do is improve the value of their tenants. So if you think about it, I invested in a 52 unit mobile home park, that's 52 families where we cleaned it up. Drug dealers were taken out of the park. Night lights were put in for security. And the investment actually performed really poorly. But the fact that we've done so much, you know, improvements and we really shaped the lives of those people, you can't get that many other places.
Right. Man, that's cool. That is very cool. I love that. Dennis, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
The best place is on my website, www.sihcapitalgroup.com. If you go to the education page, I have 30, 40 articles on stuff like that we talked about. I also have two abridged versions of my book, one on the actual content and one on the Q&A with the experts that you can download. And last place, if you go on Amazon and put in the Alternative Investment Almanac by Dennis Shapiro, it should come up. My first name is with one N.
Awesome. Dennis, thank you so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for having me on.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.